You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony LeTigre, Lisa Loving, Stacy Holtman, and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News and the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio. Guest host Linda Olson-Osterlund welcomes the founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund to discuss the Trump regime's efforts to keep protesters away during Inauguration Day. At 9, social and political commentary from the Old Mill Variety Hour. At 10, on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes Ben Schreiber from the Friends of the Earth. They'll talk about Trump's rogues gallery of cabinet picks and the damage they may do to the very agencies they're being tasked to lead. At 11, the Arctic report card, how the melting Arctic might affect the rest of the world. At 11:30, Voices for the Animals, giving you three compelling reasons to go vegan in the new year. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses. And have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam and Ian.
Good night.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a Trump presidency requires vigilance. Abortion access is primarily a hot topic rather than a material fact of life for women and families. We'll talk about the human beings involved in the fight for reproductive rights with Destiny Lopez of the group All Above All. Also on the show, even if Trump, who lost the popular vote, had not won the presidency, his campaign had already had an impact. Reports of hate crimes in which Trump is evoked suggest that racists, sexists, and xenophobes feel emboldened. How can reporters address this phenomenon? We'll talk about how they can and why they must with journalist A.C. Thompson from ProPublica. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. The December 19th New Yorker carries a piece by Malcolm Gladwell in which he compares Edward Snowden unfavorably to Daniel Ellsberg, in part because Ellsberg went to better schools. Quote, Snowden did not study under a Nobel Prize winner or give career advice to the likes of Henry Kissinger. He was a community college dropout, a member of the murky hacking counterculture. Close quote. Glenn Greenwald called out that class bias, but Fair's Jim Noricus notes something more surprising, Gladwell's take on the role of anonymous leaks. In a properly functioning media system, Gladwell argues, the purpose of leaks is to fool people into accepting government indoctrination, and it would be a shame if that system were to break down. The argument is borrowed from Columbia Law professor David Posen, who Gladwell says argues that governments look the other way when it comes to leaks because it is in their interest to do so. Posen makes a distinction between unauthorized leaks and plants, the latter being a leak made with the full authorization of the White House. The article cites an anonymously sourced story about CIA drone strikes in Yemen. We're told that sort of plant works for the government because it, quote, keeps the American people minimally informed of its pursuits and characterizes them in a manner designed to build support, close quote. But if you want to reserve your right to plant, it is critical that relevant audiences not immediately assume that every unattributed disclosure they encounter reflects a concerted White House effort to manipulate the information environment. And Gladwell adds, quote, in a world where every stealthy disclosure is a plant, the journalist is a stooge and the administration's motives are transparent. But when the origin of the disclosure is uncertain, all parties save face, close quote. Note that for Gladwell, for the government's motives to be transparent is a bad thing. If readers spot the effort to manipulate the information environment, then the government attempt to build support will fail. Likewise, being recognized as a journalistic stooge is a bad thing. An undetected stooge is not a problem. In short, Gladwell writes, quote, the relationship between the government and the press, between the source of leaks and the beneficiary of leaks, is symbiotic, close quote. In Gladwell's view, Daniel Ellsberg leaking the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times was an example of this. Quote, a studious political science PhD wishes to instruct the upper echelon of American leadership in the benefits of reading several thousand pages of history, and, after his initial efforts prove unavailing, assigns a carefully curated set of course materials to the most august institution in American journalism. This isn't the behavior of a dissident, close quote. Well, it's funny, Ellsberg didn't see it that way, nor did Nixon, who rails against Ellsberg as a radical and part of a conspiracy against him in the Watergate tapes. For his part, Ellsberg expressed no interest in getting the upper echelons of American leadership to read the papers. He explained in an interview, quote, the only thing that I could personally hope to achieve by my own efforts was to make these documents available to the American public for them to read and to learn from. What the Pentagon Papers told me when I read them was that the executive branch was determined not to learn lessons from its experience in Vietnam. The history in the Pentagon Papers told me that if others were to learn a different lesson, it would have to be people outside the executive branch, and they would have to have the physical capability to read the papers, close quote. Well, despite Ellsberg's avowed interest in bringing the history of the Vietnam War to the people, Gladwell presents him as the quintessential leaker, saying leakers, quote, are interested in using and exploiting secrecy. They believe that secrecy, by its preservation and strategic violation, serves an essential purpose, close quote. Gladwell presents Edward Snowden as engaged in an entirely different activity. Quote, Snowden didn't leak in the traditional sense. He flooded, and in that difference of degree is a difference in kind. A much-needed national conversation about the NSA's encroachment on civil liberties became sidetracked by debates about his own motivations. Close quote. Gladwell imagines a character named Daniel Snowberg and tells readers, quote, Daniel Snowberg, the insider, would have sparked a national debate that focused on the question of what access the NSA should have had to the private data of ordinary American citizens. Snowberg would have stood as someone who restored the legitimacy of the national intelligence apparatus, who embarrassed the executive branch in the short term in order to preserve the prerogatives of the executive branch in the long term. Close quote. Yes. If only Snowden had been an overeducated insider who valued the preservation of secrecy and wanted only to use and exploit secrets in order to preserve government power, then we could have had a real debate about civil liberties. Instead, having tried to expose the secrets of an abusive government to the public, just like Daniel Ellsberg did, Snowden will have to wait 45 years for the inheritors of Malcolm Gladwell's style of establishment journalism to fantasize that he was an insider all along. You are listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Women's reproductive rights, never universally comfortably secure, are in clear and present danger under a Trump administration. But much media coverage of abortion has been marked by a static pro-con framing that presents it as, above all, a political football rather than a question of women's fundamental human rights. As Trump emboldened lawmakers push forward more heartbeat bills and waiting period restrictions, we have to ask if media will rise to the challenge, including acknowledging that, as it stands, all women are not equal when it comes to the ability to make critical reproductive choices. Destiny Lopez is co-director of All Above All, a coalition of groups and individuals working to lift the bans that deny abortion coverage. She joins us now by phone from North Carolina. Welcome to Counterspin, Destiny Lopez.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Donald Trump has said he'll defund Planned Parenthood. He'll put anti-choice justices on the Supreme Court. He'll sign a 20-week abortion ban. We know that harassment at clinics is already up. There's a lot to fear and to think about here. But as with other issues, I think I hear folks saying, let's start with the most vulnerable. You know, when it comes to abortion access, who does that mean?
So I think that means the constituencies that my campaign really focuses on and cares about, women of color and young folks. They are the ones who are disproportionately impacted by any bans on abortion, restrictions of abortion, any attempts to undercut abortion access in this country ultimately are going to disproportionately impact those groups of women.
Yeah, it seems important to recognize that the rights that we're saying are in jeopardy, some women effectively don't really have them now. I think the Hyde Amendment people think of as ancient history, it's very much with us, isn't it?
It is very much with us, and it's been with us for the last 40 years. So we just marked the 40th year of the Hyde Amendment. And really, you know, Trump and Pence and now the anti-abortion leadership in Congress, since they have both houses, want to make it harder to prevent unintended pregnancy and ultimately impossible to get abortion, but they penalize women, right, for having children as well. And so we don't have to imagine what it looks like when they push it out of reach because, frankly, they already do this with Hyde.
Right.
You know, as you said, it bans insurance coverage for abortion for women enrolled in Medicaid. And again, those are brown and black folks. Young tend to be younger folks as well.
Well, Hyde was clear that he wanted to ban all abortion, but this was just the part that he had control over, you know, and mm-hmm. you just mentioned it, but maybe just spell out who is affected by Hyde.
Sure. So if you think about who is part of the Medicaid program, obviously that's a broad swath of Americans, but disproportionately those are women of color, Black women in particular, as well as Latino women, as well as young folks are all folks who are part of that program. But now what we've seen also since Hyde was originally enshrined into law 40 years ago, all of these kind of copycat amendments have been added. So now if you're in the Peace Corps or if you get your care through the Indian Health Service, if you're a federal employee, if you are in a federal detention center, including immigrants who are in federal detention centers, all of those groups of folks also have the same restrictions. So all of them are not allowed to use federal funds to access abortion care unless it's in the cases of the health of the mother, rape, or incest. So, you know, it went from a very small group of folks to a much larger group of folks. And, you know, we see that punishment of women that Trump said over and over in the campaign that he wanted to punish women is already happening with Hyde.
Well, the fact that these restrictions fall heaviest on low-income women is not surprising in a way, but it's not really the only way that economics and abortion are related. I mean, the ability to determine whether or not to have a child can mean the difference between falling below the poverty line or not. It seems clear, but the economic impact of abortion rights, it seems to me, is rarely explored, at least in the media.
That's right. And what we know is, particularly when it comes to the Hyde Amendment, that pushing abortion coverage out of reach of women forces one in four poor women to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term. So you have to imagine what that looks like for a woman in her real life. She likely has other children already. She might want to pursue a career or education, and that becomes further and further out of reach for women. And those are all kind of bread and butter economic issues from a woman's point of view. And we don't, I think you're right, we don't talk about that enough. And part of the work that we do at All Above All is really to make those connections. You know, we fundamentally believe that regardless of how a woman gets her insurance, how much money she makes, or where she lives, that she should have access to the same reproductive health care, including abortion, as any other woman. And so if you think about the patchwork we've now created, you know, federal funding is prohibited. There are a number of states that provide Medicaid funding through their own state funds, but that's, you know, 17 states out of our 50 states. So in those other 30 plus states, women don't have access to Medicaid coverage. So we've created this kind of uneven pattern of access throughout the country, which you also see in terms of the number of abortion providers women have, the number of restrictions that women have depending on the state that they live in. So it's just this patchwork that really ultimately comes down to how much money you make and where you live, whether you're actually going to get the care that is rightfully ours.
Which, needless to say, is not the way you manage something that is genuinely seen as a right, you know, that is seen as a human right, that access.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I remember reading Brenda Wright from the group Demos talking about this and pointing out that something like 7 in 10 women who had abortions were saying they would have had them earlier, but their delay was due to a lack of funds, you know, and that, and connecting, in other words, women's autonomy and economic security with, you know, we're supposedly interested in working families. Well, this is a core issue for a working family, you know, for their economic lives.
Absolutely. In a prior part of my career, I worked with an abortion fund, and we were providing daily to women who were seeking abortion care money for their procedure or a tank of gas so they could get to that procedure, a place to stay for an overnight, you know, an overnight procedure. You know, all the scraping that women has to do to get together the money and the support that she needs, logistical and otherwise, to actually just get to access healthcare again, that's considered a right. You know, I don't think we talk enough about that process either, what it takes for a woman, you know, both the decision-making she goes through to make that decision, and then once she's made her decision, the kind of hoops she has to go through, and a lot of them are financial, in order to actually access care.
Well, one of the shocking to many election results is that 52% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And I just read that reproductive rights groups had a strategy meeting recently and determined that women of color should take the lead in that fight. I wonder what you think about that. What's the thinking behind that recentering? It seems to me a positive development.
Yeah, I had the privilege of being at that meeting. Well, so one thing I'll say is, and I'm a Latina, so I identify as a woman of color, we have been at the leading, particularly mm-hmm. on the issue of the Hyde Amendment. We have been at the forefront of this movement to repeal the Hyde Amendment for many, many years, but really a resurgence in that effort since All Above All came onto the scene about 5 or 6 years ago. So I think if we look at who was under attack during this election cycle, right, it was undocumented folks, Black women, men and children, Muslim Americans, low-income people, and people of color more generally. You know, those were the folks who were under attack, who Trump said vicious things about. Those are also the people who showed up at the polls, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we can look at the numbers of who didn't show up, but if we looked at who showed up, the amazing number of Black women who showed up, you know, Latinos broke for Hillary, mm-hmm. Young folks broke for Hillary. When we look at those folks, they're there with us, and we need to continue to engage those constituencies, engage our communities in dialogue about these issues, because they're also part of the new American majority. So their numbers are going to be increasing as voters, and we must be responsive to their concerns. And what that also means then is we can't just be talking about abortion access or reproductive rights in a silo. We have to come at this through a justice framework, which means we have to stand with folks fighting for racial justice, for fair wages, for tribal sovereignty. You know, we have to center the voices and leadership of women of color in all of those conversations, and we have to do this work in an intersectional way.
So maybe, as on other fronts, it's really an acknowledgement of the leadership that's been going on all this time in any event.
Absolutely.
Finally, it's not that journalists don't talk about abortion or don't talk about reproductive rights. They do. But I just wonder, how could media support and highlight the work that's being done? What would you like to see?
I do think one of the things we see oftentimes is a lot of assumptions, particularly around the beliefs and values of folks of color around these issues, right? So there's a myth that, for example, Latinos are Catholic and therefore they're anti-choice. And we have amazing research from the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health that says, in fact, they're with us on this issue. You just have to talk to them in a different way about it, right? So I think there's a lot of mythology around how Black and brown folks in particular feel about these issues. We know from our work on the Hyde Amendment that majorities of African Americans, Latinos, API communities actually support our work to ensure that every woman has access regardless of how much money she makes or where she lives. I think the media can help us bust some of this mythology. I think they can lift up voices from communities of color as their spokespeople on these issues, because they're going to help you both talk about, you know, reproductive rights and justice issues, but also make those linkages to Black Lives Matter, to the immigration rights fight. If we've learned nothing else from this cycle, is that, you know, as progressives, we really need to come from a values-based approach, and we really need to be doing movement work across progressive issues. And I think, at least in our movement, women of color leadership has been doing that for a long, long time. And so to me, having the media shine a spotlight on that leadership and how we lead is going to be really important.
We've been speaking with Destiny Lopez, co-director of All Above All. You can find them and their work online at allaboveall.org. Destiny Lopez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
There are pundits who still say we should wait and see what a Trump White House will do before expressing concerns. But that ignores how Trump's media-assisted prominence, the mainstreaming of his brand of brazen hatred, has encouraged and emboldened racist, sexist xenophobes around the country already. Donald Trump didn't invent hate crime, but he has put the relationship between legitimizing talk and violent action on a plate for media. So how will a press corps that still talks about race relations when they mean white supremacy deal with the particular brew now concocted? We're joined now by reporter A.C. Thompson, co-author of the book Torture Taxi, On the Trail of the CIA's Rendition Flights. He works now at ProPublica, joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, A.C. Thompson.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we hear, of course, anecdotally or through social media about individual hate crimes, people who are targeted for harassment or for violence because of their perceived ethnicity or religion or gender. I think people might be a little surprised to learn that the official data collection on the problem is really not very good, is it?
It's abysmal. What's going on is that there's federal law that's been in place since about 1990 that says, hey, FBI, you have to go out to state and local cops and ask them what's going on with hate crimes in their jurisdictions. The problem is those local and state authorities are not compelled to compile decent statistics and give them to the FBI. So a lot of departments just don't participate. About 20% across the country don't participate at all. And then the others that do participate, I think a lot of them are lackadaisical. So in some of these states where we know there's a significant number of hate crimes, you're getting reports of 2, 3, 5 hate crimes a year. And people that follow this know that's simply not true.
Well, we saw James Comey come out and apologize for the lack of data. He seems to do that a lot. He was apologizing that the FBI didn't have good numbers on law enforcement killing of Black people. And he's saying on this, too, yeah, we don't have so much to go on. Is it your sense that there is a lack of motivation, perhaps, to collect these things? Or is it really just that it's more work to do?
You know, there's several things going on here. One is that at the local level, a lot of local law enforcement officials don't necessarily know what they're dealing with, even today when they get a hate crime in their jurisdiction. So if you have a verbal assault that involves a racial epithet, that may get written up and reported as simply as a verbal assault and not as a hate crime in lots of different places. So that's one problem, is sort of training and the actual police work on the ground. The next problem is that there are no penalties for law enforcement agencies that don't submit accurate data to the FBI. And the FBI has not pushed them to submit accurate data. They have not been particularly forceful about getting decent data on a lot of fronts from state and local law enforcement. And so it just hasn't happened. There has been legislation that was introduced last congressional session saying, hey, this has got to change. Federal funding is going to be tied to departments accurately reporting hate crime information, and that legislation didn't go anywhere. So it'll be interesting to see if this comes up again in the next congressional session.
Well, of course, data by itself is not reporting. You have to talk to people or more importantly, listen to people. What is the project that ProPublica is involved with? What are the goals of what you're trying to do around collecting this information?
What we're doing is we're building a big coalition that involves civil rights groups, ethnic media, journalism students, and mainstream journalism outlets. And basically, what we're trying to do is create a complementary data set to the FBI's data. And what we're looking for are both things that would be defined under state laws or federal law as a hate crime, but also acts of intimidation and harassment that don't rise to that level. A lot of things that we're seeing on social media and Twitter, for example. And we are building this team to really try to understand, document, and react positively to this moment where we have a very direct linkage between political speech and crimes on the ground.
You know, you were talking about police departments not knowing maybe the definition or not categorizing things as hate crimes. And I think the same thing can go for journalists. You know, your motives are always going to be murky. You know, somebody is always going to have a friend who says they don't have a racist bone in their body. You know, I'm not trying to minimize the difficulty of getting a hold of this issue, you know, of talking about it. But of course, we have to talk about it. I mean, we have to.
Absolutely. I think what's unique about this moment in modern American history is that you have some very clear signs that what is happening, a lot of it relates very directly to the presidential election. So when you see graffiti that is a spin on the Trump campaign slogan, Make America Great Again, that says Make America White Again, and there's a big, huge swastika, well, we know that this is a hate crime related to politics, to the current president-elect. When we see swastikas and the word Trump at a park in Brooklyn, we know what that's about. And a lot of the crimes that have occurred since the election that have been documented by groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center have quite clearly been connected to the political moment.
Well, you just mentioned Southern Poverty Law Center. When I was speaking with Heidi Byrick from that group, she told me that journalists tell her that they don't want to report on white supremacy or on racist acts because they have a sense that exposing it is legitimizing or almost glamorizing it. And that seems like an unwinning strategy. But I think it's partly because some journalists have kind of painted themselves into this corner of objectivity where they can't say things are bad or wrong. And I think it leads to a kind of undercoverage. I mean, I wonder, what are you looking for from journalists on this? Obviously to use the data, but what would you like to see reporters doing? You're a reporter who doesn't just count numbers, but actually goes out and talks to people. What sort of journalism do you think would be helpful in this moment?
You know, my belief is different than the people who say, oh, you know, we can't cover this because it's sort of legitimizing these kooks and giving them the attention they deserve. I think we have to report on every one of these incidents that we can verify and that we can get out there and interview people about. I think that's crucial. And I think what we need to do is do this journalism that in part is simply witnessing a very, very scary time in our lives and giving voice to the people who feel terrified. There are people in my community who feel terrified. We've had two very significant hate crimes in my community where I live. And those people, my neighbors, they need to be able to speak and say, hey, this is incredibly scary to us. It's tragic. It's very, very upsetting. And we need somebody to listen to us. And I think the goal of journalism in this moment is to generate some sort of reaction, whether that's a popular reaction that says, hey, we are not going to tolerate racism, ethnic hatred, and the rest in our community, or whether that's an official reaction that says, hey, we are going to take every one of these crimes absolutely seriously, and we're going to put people away if they are attacking one another based on religious beliefs or based on their race or ethnicity or gender orientation. I think the goal of journalism at this time is to provoke some sort of meaningful response from the public and from officialdom that says this is not something that will be tolerated.
We've been speaking with A.C. Thompson, reporter at ProPublica. Find them online at ProPublica.org. A.C. Thompson, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
Give to KBOO today during our end-of-year match. Wrapping up December 31st, donations from all new and increasing members will be matched one-to-one up to $15,000 from the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Give an extra gift today or become a new member and your membership will be doubled to support independent community media and citizen journalism at KBOO. Thank you.
And Color, you are live on air.
Yes, a kookaburra bird is what I have an impersonation of.
Oh, this is wonderful. Kookaburra.
They're also from Australia.
That's right.
Okay, ready?
Yes, we are ready. That was amazing. That was... we don't know what to say about that, except thank you.
Thank you.
Tune in to The Confessional with 2 solid hours of conscience-cleansing radio. Sundays at midnight, only on KBOO FM Portland.
Bread and Roses.